This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information and to find out how you can volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recorded by Dilini Jaisingh. The History of England from the Accession of James II by Thomas Babington Macaulay. Book 1, Chapter 1, Part 14. During 5 months, the administration of Richard Cromwell went on so tranquilly and regularly that all Europe believed him to be firmly established on the chair of state. In truth, his situation was in some respects much more advantageous than that of his father. The young man had made no enemy. His hands were unstained by civil blood. The Cavaliers themselves allowed him to be an honest, good-natured gentleman. The Presbyterian party, powerful both in numbers and in wealth, had been a deadly feud with the late Protector, but was disposed to regard the present Protector with favour. That party had always been desirous to see the old civil polity of the realm restored with some clearer definitions and some stronger safeguards for public liberty, but had many reasons for dreading the restoration of the old family. Richard was the very man for politicians of this description. His humanity, ingenuousness, and modesty, the mediocrity of his abilities, and the docility with which he submitted to the guidance of persons wiser than himself, admirably qualified him to be the head of a limited monarchy. For a time it seemed highly probable that he would, under the direction of able advisers, effect what his father had attempted in vain. A parliament was called, and the writs were directed after the old fashion. The small boroughs which had recently been disfranchised regained their lost privilege. Manchester, Leeds, and Halifax ceased to return members, and the county of York was again limited to 2 knights. It may seem strange to a generation which has been excited almost to madness by the question of parliamentary reform that great shires and towns should have submitted with patience and even with complacency to this change, but though speculative, men might, even in that age, discern the vices of the old representative system and predict that those vices would, sooner or later, produce serious practical evil. The practical evil had not yet been felt. Oliver's representative system, on the other hand, though constructed on sound principles, was not popular. Both the events in which it originated and the effects which it had produced prejudiced men against it. It had sprung from military violence. It had been fruitful of nothing but disputes. The whole nation was sick of government by the sword and pined for government by the law. The restoration, therefore, even of anomalies and abuses which were in strict conformity with the law and which had been destroyed by the sword, gave general satisfaction. Among the commons there was a strong opposition, consisting partly of avowed republicans and partly of concealed royalists, but a large and steady majority appeared to be favourable to the plan of reviving the old civil constitution under a new dynasty. Richard was solemnly recognised as first magistrate. The commons not only consented to transact business with Oliver's lords, but passed a vote acknowledging the right of those nobles who had, in the late troubles, taken the side of public liberty to sit in the upper house of parliament without any new creation. Thus far, the statesmen by whose advice Richard acted had been successful. Almost all the parts of the government were now constituted as they had been constituted at the commencement of the civil war. Had the Protector and the Parliament been suffered to proceed undisturbed, there can be little doubt that an order of things similar to that which was afterwards established under the House of Hanover would have been established under the House of Cromwell. But there was in the state a power more than sufficient to deal with Protector and Parliament together. Over the soldiers, Richard had no authority except that which should derive from the great name which he had inherited. He had never led them to victory. He had never even borne arms. All his tastes and habits were pacific, nor were his opinions and feelings on religious subjects approved by the military saints. That he was a good man, he evinced by proofs more satisfactory than deep groans or long sermons, by humility and suavity when he was at the height of human greatness, and by cheerful resignation under cruel wrongs and misfortunes. But the count then, common in every guardroom, gave him a disgust which he had not always the prudence to conceal. The officers who had the principal influence among the troops stationed near London were not his friends. They were men distinguished by valour and conduct in the field, but destitute of the wisdom and civil courage which had been conspicuous in their diseased leader. Some of them were honest, but fanatical, independents and republicans. Of this class, Fleetwood was the representative. Others were impatient to be what Oliver had been. His rapid elevation, his prosperity and glory, his inauguration in the hall, and his George's obsequies in the abbey had inflamed their imagination. They were as well born as he, and as well educated. They could not understand why they were not as worthy to wear the purple robe, and to wield the sword of state, and they pursued the objects of their wild ambition, not, like him, with patience, vigilance, sagacity, and determination, but with the restlessness and irresolution characteristic of aspiring mediocrity. Among these feeble copies of a great original, the most conspicuous was Lambert. On the very day of Richard's accession, the officers began to conspire against their new master. The good understanding which existed between him and his parliament hastened the crisis. Alarm and resentment spread through the camp. Both the religious and the professional feelings of the army were deeply wounded. It seemed that the independents were to be subjected to the Presbyterians, and that the men of the sword were to be subjected to the men of the gown. A coalition was formed between the military malcontents and the republican minority of the House of Commons. It may well be doubted whether Richard could have triumphed over that coalition, even if he had inherited his father's clear judgment and iron courage. It is certain that simplicity and meekness, like his, were not the qualities which the conjuncture required. He fell ingloriously and without a struggle. He was used by the army as an instrument for the purpose of dissolving the parliament, and was then contemptuously thrown aside. The officers gratified their republican allies by declaring that the expulsion of the Rump had been illegal, and by inviting that assembly to resume its functions. The old speaker and a quorum of the old members came together and were proclaimed amidst the scarcely stifled derision and execration of the whole nation the supreme power in the Commonwealth. It was at the same time expressly declared that there should be no first magistrate and no House of Lords. But this state of things could not last. On the day on which the Long Parliament revived also its old quarrel with the army. Again the Rump forgot that it owed its existence to the pleasure of the soldiers, and began to treat them as subjects. Again the doors of House of Commons were closed by military violence, and a provisional government named by the officers assumed the direction of affairs. Meanwhile, the sense of great evils, and the strong apprehension of still greater evils close at hand, had at length produced an alliance between the Cavaliers and the Presbyterians. Some Presbyterians had, indeed, been disposed to such an alliance even before the death of Charles I, but it was not till after the fall of Richard Cromwell that the whole party became eager for the restoration of the royal house. There was no longer any reasonable hope that the old constitution could be re-established under a new dynasty. One choice only was left, the Stuarts or the army. The banished family had committed great faults, but it had dearly expiated those faults, and had undergone a long, and it might be hoped, a salutary training in the school of adversity. It was probable that Charles II would take warning by the fate of Charles I. But, be this as it might, the dangers which threatened the country were such that, in order to avert them, some opinions might well be compromised, and some risks might well be incurred. It seemed but too likely that England would fall under the most odious and degrading of all kinds of government, under a government uniting all the evils of despotism to all the evils of anarchy. Anything was preferable to the yoke of a succession of incapable and inglorious tyrants, raised to power, like the days of Barbary, by military revolutions recurring at short intervals. Lambert seemed likely to be the first of these rulers, but within a year Lambert might give place to Desborough, and Desborough to Harrison. As often as the truncheon was transferred from one feeble hand to another, the nation would be pillaged for the purpose of bestowing a fresh donative on the troops. If the Presbyterians obstinately stood aloof from the Royalists, the state was lost. And men might well doubt whether, by the combined exertions of Presbyterians and Royalists, it could be saved. For the dread of that invincible army was in all the inhabitants of the island, and the Cavaliers, taught by 100 disastrous fields how little numbers can effect against discipline, were even more completely cowed than the Roundheads. While the soldiers remained united, all the plots and risings of the malcontents were ineffectual. But a few days after the second expulsion of the Rump came tidings which gladdened the hearts of all who were attached either to monarchy or to liberty. That mighty force which had, during many years, acted as one man, and which, while so acting, had been found irresistible, was at length divided against itself. The army of Scotland had done good service to the Commonwealth, and was in the highest state of efficiency. It had borne no part in the great revolutions, and had seen them with indignation resembling the indignation which the Roman legions posted on the Danube and the Euphrates felt when they learned that the empire had been put up to sale by the Praetorian guards. It was intolerable that certain regiments should, merely because they happened to be quartered near Westminster, take on themselves to make and unmake several garments in the course of half a year. If it were fit that the state should be regulated by the soldiers, those soldiers who upheld the English ascendancy on the north of the Tweed were as well entitled to a voice as those who garrisoned the Tower of London. There appears to have been less fanaticism among the troops stationed in Scotland than in any other part of the army, and their general, George Monk, was himself the very opposite of a zealot. He had, at the commencement of the Civil War, borne arms with the king, had been made prisoner by the Roundheads, had then accepted a commission from the Parliament, and with very slender pretensions to saintship had raised himself to high commands by his courage and professional skill. He had been a useful servant to both the protectors, and had quietly acquiesced when the officers at Westminster had pulled down Richard and restored the Long Parliament, and would perhaps have acquiesced as quietly in the second expulsion of the Long Parliament, if the provisional government had abstained from giving him cause of offence and apprehension. For his nature was cautious and somewhat sluggish, nor was he at all disposed to hazard sure and moderate advantages for the chalice of obtaining even the most splendid success. He seems to have been impelled to attack the new rulers of the Commonwealth less by the hope that, if he overthrew them, he should become great, than by the fear that, if he submitted to them, he should not even be secure. Whatever were his motives, he declared himself the champion of the oppressed civil power, refused to acknowledge the usurped authority of the provisional government, and, at the head of 7,000 veterans, marched into England. This step was the signal for a general explosion. The people everywhere refused to pay taxes. The apprentices of the city assembled by thousands and clamoured for a free parliament. The fleet sailed up the Thames and declared against the tyranny of the soldiers. The soldiers, no longer under the control of one commanding mind, separated into factions. Every regiment, afraid lest it should be left alone a mark for the vengeance of the oppressed nation, hastened to make a separate peace. Lambert, who had hastened northward to encounter the army of Scotland, was abandoned by his troops and became a prisoner. During 13 years, the civil power had, in every conflict, been compelled to yield to the military power. The military power now humbled itself before the civil power. The Rump, generally hated and despised, but still the only body in the country which had any show of legal authority, returned again to the house from which it had been twice ignominiously expelled. In the meantime, Monk was advancing towards London. Wherever he came, the gentry flocked around him, imploring him to use his power for the purpose of restoring peace and liberty to the distracted nation. The general, cold-blooded, taciturn, zealous for no polity and for no religion, maintained an impenetrable reserve. What were at this time his plans, and whether he had any plan, may well be doubted. His great object, apparently, was to keep himself, as long as possible, free to choose between several lines of action. Such, indeed, is commonly the policy of men who are, like him, distinguished rather by wariness than by far-sightedness. It was probably not till he had been some days in the capital that he had made up his mind. The cry of the whole people was for free parliament, and there could be no doubt that a parliament really free would instantly restore the exiled family. The Rump and the soldiers were still hostile to the House of Stuart, but the Rump was universally detested and despised. The power of the soldiers was indeed still formidable, but had been greatly diminished by discord. They had no head. They had recently been, in many parts of the country, arrayed against each other. On the very day before Monk reached London, there was a fight in the Strand between the cavalry and the infantry. An united army had long kept down a divided nation, but the nation was now united and the army was divided. During a short time, the dissimulation or irresolution of Monk kept all parties in a state of painful suspense. At length he broke silence and declared for a free parliament. As soon as his declaration was known, the whole nation was wild with delight. Wherever he appeared, thousands thronged round him, shouting and blessing his name. The bells of all England rang joyously, the gutters ran with ale, and night after night the sky 5 miles round London was reddened by innumerable bonfires. Those Presbyterian members of the House of Commons, who had many years before been expelled by the army, returned to their seats, and were hailed with acclamations by great multitudes, which filled Westminster Hall and Palace Yard. The independent leaders no longer dared to show their faces in the streets, and were scarcely safe within their own dwellings. Temporary provision was made for the government, writs were issued for a general election, and then that memorable parliament, which had in the course of 20 eventful years experienced every variety of fortune, which had triumphed over its sovereign, which had been enslaved and degraded by its servants, which had been twice ejected and twice restored, solemnly decreed its own dissolution. The result of the elections was such as might have been expected from the temper of the nation. The new House of Commons consisted, with few exceptions, of persons friendly to the royal family. The Presbyterians formed the majority. That there would be a restoration now seemed almost certain, but whether there would be a peaceable restoration was a matter of painful doubt. The soldiers were in a gloomy and savage mood. They hated the title of king. They hated the name of Stuart. They hated Presbyterianism much, and prelacy more. They saw with bitter indignation that the close of their long domination was approaching, and that a life of inglorious toil and penury was before them. They attributed their ill fortune to the weakness of some generals and to the treason of others. 1 hour of their beloved Oliver might even now restore the glory which had departed. Betrayed, disunited, and left without any chief in whom they could confide, they were yet to be dreaded. It was no light thing to encounter the rage and despair of 50,000 fighting men, whose backs no enemy had ever seen. Monk and those with whom he acted were well aware that the crisis was most perilous. They employed every art to soothe and to divide the discontented warriors. At the same time, vigorous preparation was made for a conflict. The army of Scotland, now quartered in London, was kept in good humour by bribes, praises and promises. The wealthy citizens grudged nothing to a redcoat, and were indeed so liberal of their best wine, that warlike saints were sometimes seen in a condition not very honourable, either to their religious or to their military character. some refractory regiments Monk ventured to disband. In the meantime, the greatest exertions were made by the provisional government, with the strenuous aid of the whole body of the gentry and magistracy, to organize the militia. In every county, the train bands were held ready to march, and this force cannot be estimated at less than 120,000 men. In Hyde Park, 20,000 citizens, well armed and accoutred, passed in review and showed a spirit which justified the hope that, in case of need, they would fight manfully for their shops and firesides. The fleet was heartily with the nation. It was stirring time, a time of anxiety, yet of hope. The prevailing opinion was that England would be delivered, but not without a desperate and bloody struggle, and that the class which had so long ruled by the sword would perish by the sword. Happily, the dangers of a conflict were averted. There was indeed one moment of extreme peril. Lambert escaped from his confinement and called his comrades to arms. The flame of civil war was actually rekindled, but by prompt and vigorous exertion, it was trodden out before it had time to spread. The luckless imitator of Cromwell was again a prisoner. The failure of his enterprise damned the spirit of the soldiers, and they sullenly resigned themselves to their fate. The new parliament, which, having been called without the royal writ, is more accurately described as a convention, met at Westminster. The lords repaired to the hall, from which they had during more than 11 years been excluded by force. Both houses instantly invited the king to return to his country. He was proclaimed with pomp never before known. A gallant fleet convoyed him from Holland to the coast of Kent. When he landed, the cliffs of Dover were covered by thousands of gazers, among whom scarcely one could be found who was not weeping with delight. The journey to London was a continuous triumph. The whole road from Rochester was bordered by booths and tents, and looked like an interminable fair. Everywhere flags were flying, bells and music sounding, wine and ale flowing in rivers to the health of him whose return was the return of peace, of law and of freedom. But in the midst of the general joy, one spot presented a dark and threatening aspect. On Blackheath, the army was drawn up to welcome the sovereign. He smiled, bowed and extended his hand graciously to the lips of the colonels and majors. But all his courtesy was vain. The countenances of the soldiers were sad and lowering, and had they given away to their feelings, the festive pageant of which they reluctantly made a part would have had a mournful and bloody end. But there was no concert among them. Discord and defection had left them no confidence in their chiefs or in each other. The whole array of the city of London was under arms. Numerous companies of militia had assembled from various parts of the realm under the command of loyal noblemen and gentlemen to welcome the king. That great day closed in peace, and the restored wanderer reposed safe in the palace of his ancestors. End of part 14. End of History of England, Volume 1, Chapter 1. By Thomas Babington Macaulay.